This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right then, let's go. Hello, welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. My name is Dan. This is the place where only the most amazing, weird and deadly things in the universe are allowed to get through the door. And we got a bit of a spacey themed show actually today. We're learning about what scientists think is the largest thing in the universe in this week's Dangerous Dan in a bit. Also, we'll chat to Libby Jackson in a sec. Now, Libby applied for school for some work experience at NASA. I know. So many people have work experience down the local shop at the post office. She went big all the way to NASA, and then years later she got to control her own mission into space. And we'll get one of your science questions answered by our expert Tom as well. Today it's all about one of the most famous experiments in science history. That's on the way later. First, let's head down then to the dark depths of the universe, to the only school in the solar system, and find out why soon we could go to holiday in space.
Deep Space High, Spaceports.
Okay, everyone at Deep Space High, I'm ready to transmit my presentation on spaceports. You're gonna love it. Transmitting in 3, 2, 1. Have you ever imagined being an astronaut, experiencing weightlessness as you orbit the Earth, maybe visiting a neighbouring planet? Now, obviously, we're pretty lucky because we get to go to Deep Space High. But check this out. In the near future, everyone on Earth might have a chance to go into space and fly in the same way as they travel by air from airports. All thanks to spaceports. Just imagine a holiday on Jupiter, a trip to the moon and back, or maybe just a short flight to the edge of the Earth's atmosphere. These all sound like really cool things to do, right? Well, there are a lot of people who would agree with you about that. Even though there are over 7 billion people on Earth, only around 550 men and women have ever gone into space.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
For decades, space exploration has been run by governments, so members of the public like you and me haven't really had a look in. But things are set to change. You might have seen on the news that there are commercial companies developing technology to offer suborbital flights for ordinary people. Well, ordinary rich people at the moment. One is a company called Virgin Galactic, which is owned by a guy called Richard Branson. Another is SpaceX. It's owned by someone called Elon Musk. You might have heard of him. He is also behind the Tesla electric cars. In fact, there's a whole bunch of companies working on ways to get people into space. Commercial space launches are already taking place all the time across Earth, but most don't involve people at all. Some will be carrying astronauts and supplies to the International Space Station. Others are taking satellites into orbit around Earth. Satellites are very important to everyday life on Earth. They deliver TV programs and send us coordinates for our sat-navs. They also undertake scientific experiments, like monitoring the Earth's atmosphere. Now, one big problem facing any launch, whether for people, supplies, or satellites, is that you need a lot of power to get out of the Earth's gravitational pull. And you can't launch from anywhere. You need special spaceports. At the moment, there aren't any spaceports in my home country, the UK. And you have to go to America and Russia, or further afield to Australia and Brazil to hitch a ride. That can take a long time and cost a lot of money. It would be much simpler and cheaper if space companies could send up their spacecraft closer to where they're built. And this is where things are changing. The British government wants the UK to be the first country in Europe from which commercial flights can be launched. Now, what spaceports look like and where they'll be are questions which haven't been answered yet. But I'll be giving you the lowdown on it all in my amazing presentations on Spaceports UK. Uh-oh, losing the connection. Catch you next time.
Deep Space High, Spaceports. Support for the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
We've got loads of episodes and adventures from Deep Space High that you can catch up on for free. Remember, it's all on your phone or tablet, wherever you get your podcasts from, you know, places like iTunes. Also, it's on the free Fun Kids app, and you can listen at funkidslive.com. Now, does your school make you do work experience? Have you heard of this before? It's where you have to go and get a regular job for a week and be an adult, not be at school. It's meant to make you learn what the real world is like. Yeah, most people I know went to like local shops, or some worked in an office. I went to a recruitment agent's, yeah, which was as thrilling as it sounds. And it's probably now why I play songs on the radio. Now, our special guest this week, though, her work experience did her well. She went to NASA Mission Control. And many years later, she's still helping humans explore space. We'll ask Libby Jackson exactly how in just a sec. First, we need to give the big Fun Kid shout-out wheel a spin and see who's getting a hello on the show today. You see, all the names on this wheel, by the way, they're people who have left the Fun Kid Science Weekly a review on iTunes. Spinning, stopping, now, there we go. Today it's landed on Football Master Jake. Hello, Jake. Thanks for leaving us a review. Very simply, he says, I love the show. Well, Jake, very simply, I love the fact you're listening and that you've left us a review. Thanks so much. If you want a shout out next week, by the way, you need to get on the spinning wheel in the Fun Kid studio. To do that, make sure you leave the Fun Kid Science Weekly a review on the iTunes podcast store. It's the Fun Kid Science Weekly. Now we're heading into the deep dark universe with today's guest. Libby Jackson is Human Spaceflight and Microgravity Program Manager at the UK Space Agency. And she's on the show right now to tell us all about what's going on in the universe. Libby, hello.
Hello.
Now, very quickly, I want to start off. What's the most pressing issue on the mind of astronauts and people in NASA right now when we're talking of exploring space? Like, we once went to the moon. What are we thinking of doing right now?
Right now, NASA, the European Space Agency, and other international partners, we're starting to think about a new little space station called the Deep Space Gateway, which would be out in an orbit towards the moon. And we're talking about putting this together to allow us to send humans back to the surface of the moon and onto Mars and explore for the first time since the 1970s the region of the solar system beyond the Earth and our little low Earth orbit, which is where the space station sits. And we're also thinking about what is the future of the International Space Station and the future of doing science in that low Earth orbit.
Well, you've mentioned the future there. I guess we should talk about the future of space exploration then. How far are we thinking in the future? Like, what do we already know what we're planning to do in, say, 2050?
Oh, no, 2050 is, for me, a long, long time away. I hope that by then we might be seeing humans at Mars, that they will have made it there. NASA are talking about getting humans to Mars in the 2030s. Space travel and space exploration is always hard and difficult, and sometimes it takes longer than you think, so maybe that date will move. But certainly we are all talking about exploring out into the solar system again in the coming decades.
Yeah, well, so kind of chat about going to Mars has really monopolised conversations about space for so long now. What would people like to do once we've done that? Are we looking at colonising it perhaps in the future, or are we just going to go there, have a look around, then come back?
Well, the reason that scientists want to go to Mars and really to send humans is all about answering the question about life. Was there life on Mars? Is there life on Mars? And understand how Mars and Earth evolved differently. The planets are very similar, cousins or sisters. And way back in the formation of the solar system, we think that they had quite similar atmospheres. So why has Earth developed into this place that we live in now, you know, our planet that we call home, whereas Mars is a much thinner atmosphere and less hospitable? So we want to send humans there because they can explore the geology. They can go and search for life in ways that robots can do, but we can do more. You know, when you send humans there, you can do much more, and you can sort of assess the surface in different ways.
Libby, you've dedicated your whole life to kind of exploring space and helping the technology and the people that go up there. Tell me about the very first moment that you decided you wanted to make a career and work amongst the stars.
I always remember when I was little looking up at the stars and just being fascinated by them. And it was always an interest and a passion of mine. But I didn't know then that you could work in this field. That I discovered through school. I discovered that the UK had a space industry and that we built satellites here in the UK. And I started to think that that was something I wanted to do. And then when I was 17, we had to arrange work shadowing. We had to go and visit somebody that we thought we might like, you know, a job that we might like to do. And I said out loud to some friends, well, I want to work for NASA one day, because as far as I was concerned, NASA were the only people then who sent astronauts into space. So I emailed NASA with a friend, and we wrote to them and said, can we come and do some work shadowing? And they wrote back and said, yes. So I, aged 17, got to spend 2 weeks at the Johnson Space Center, seeing everything that human spaceflight does. And that was the first time I walked into Mission Control, where they were flying the space shuttle from, and I saw what Mission Control was all about. And that was when I thought, yes, this is what I wanted to do. I knew that was something I would enjoy doing. But even then, I didn't think it was possible. It took me years through university and through getting to know this industry to discover that you could go and work in Mission Control here in Europe.
So talk to me about Mission Control then. Obviously, my only understanding of it would be from your films, when you've got very, very angry people shouting at massive screens on a wall. What does it really look like, though?
It really is, in some ways, just like you see in films. I always say to people, have you seen Apollo 13? That really very accurately shows what Mission Control is like, or at least was in the days of when we were sending people to the moon in the Apollo mission. And it's very similar now. It's a big room with lots of screens at the front that are showing you video views of the space station, of the astronauts working. You've got clocks. You've got people in rows with desks with lots of data on their screens telling you how the spacecraft is behaving. And it's a very quiet atmosphere, very focused. Everybody's aware of the job that they're doing. You all talk to each other with headsets, so no one is really shouting across the room. And you were all there keeping the crew safe up in space, making sure that their spacecraft is in good condition. And if those two are right, then you make sure that they get their mission done and that they do the science that they're trying to do every day.
So what are you working on right now then? I mean, you've thankfully given us a few minutes of your time over the phone. Where are you right now? What are you working on? I mean, you're the Human Spaceflight and Microgravity Program Manager. It's an incredible title. What does that really involve, though, day to day?
So I now work for the UK Space Agency. We are headquartered in Swindon in Wiltshire, where I am right now. And my job is to look after everything that the UK does, both in terms of human spaceflight and also all the science that we do on the International Space Station, and also in a lot of other facilities that we have here on Earth. So you can do science in microgravity on aeroplanes when they fly these we call them parabolic flights. And you have a plane that flies through the air, and for about 20 seconds at a time, you're floating just like you're in space, and you can do science there. And we've got a number of other facilities. So I coordinate the community who do that. I talk to all the scientists and industry. And right now what I'm working on is starting to lay the groundwork to prepare the business case for us to continue our involvement in this. So I'm truly a civil servant, and I do lots of work with budgets and policy and strategy and keeping our community hopefully moving in the right direction and ensuring that our scientists have access to the facilities they need to keep doing the science.
Perfect. Libby, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
My pleasure, thank you for having me.
Right, time for today's Dangerous Dan then, where we have a look at the most mean, deadly and unpredictable things in the universe. And I was thinking, because our special guest, Libby Jackson, today was a space expert, we'd go back there to the dark depths of the universe right now. This week we're having a look at the Himiko Cloud. It's the largest object in the known universe. It's about 13 billion light years away from the Earth, and it's half the size of our galaxy, the one we're in right now, the Milky Way. Now, scientists believe it's 55,000 light years across, and it contains as much mass, as much stuff, as 40 billion of our suns. Now, it's really a gigantic mystery blob. And because it's so far away, scientists don't exactly know what it is, but they think it's a proto-galaxy, which are the leftovers from the start of a galaxy forming way back at the beginning of time. So the best way to describe it, you know when you finish your dinner, right, and there's like a few bits of potato, a few flecks of meat, and some stray peas kind of swimming around your plate in the gravy at the end? Well, it's like that. Only instead of peas, meat and gravy, it's planets and stars in there instead. Now, the Himiko Cloud, it's floating 13 billion light years away. It was made 400 million years after the Big Bang, in an early time called the Cosmic Dawn. And because scientists don't really know much about it, it makes it very dangerous. We'll get one of the questions you've sent to my page over at funkidslive.com answered by our science expert Tom on the show in just a sec. First, let's catch up with one of our other favourite experts, Professor Hallux. This is from his Physiology Fix-Up series, where he's learning how to make your body better.
Hallux's Physiology Fix-Up.
Lie still, body. It's going to be all wonky unless you stop fidgeting.
Dare I ask?
I thought that I could improve upon human skin. I've got this rather jazzy wrapping paper, which I think will make the perfect coating for the human body.
Leopard print?
Well, yes. That's the beauty of it. You could have anything you like if we used paper instead of skin. You could have some nice hearts, flowers, racing cars. If I could just cut it out, will you stop moving?
Skin does a lot of jobs. It protects you and helps keep you cool. Looking cool, though, isn't one of those jobs, as far as I know.
Well, maybe it should help us look cool. There's always room for improvement.
Yes, but the body's organs and systems have a number of jobs to do, and are able to do all these jobs because of the way they are constructed and the way they work with other parts of the body.
All right, I know. So let's put it to the test.
Loading physiology file.
Skin. Job 1, the hypodermis. This is the bottom layer of skin. It's thick and fatty to protect and insulate organs from bumps and stores energy.
Physiology fail.
I think you'll find that wrapping paper...
Leopard print wrapping paper.
Any kind of wrapping paper isn't going to protect or insulate anything very well. Not even a birthday present.
Good point. Let's see if it passes the next test.
Skin job 2, the dermis. This middle layer of skin contains blood vessels which help transfer heat to the surface to regulate temperature. And because it's made of a mesh of springy fibres, it also provides elasticity.
Well, this paper is pretty flexible too, right? See, I can scrunch it up and pull it out.
Physiology fail.
You wouldn't want your skin to rip like that. Better luck with the next one.
Skin job 3, the epidermis. This top layer of skin provides a barrier to prevent bacteria getting inside the body. It's waterproof too and contains sweat glands and hairs which keep us at the right temperature.
Wrapping paper isn't very waterproof, is it?
Nope. And I don't think it would do a very good job of keeping you warm or cool either.
Physiology fail.
Bother.
What a shame. Our skin does lots of jobs, and I think leopard print is probably best left to the leopards.
Still, learning about the body's physiology is a really good way to learn about how to look after ourselves.
That's true. If skin gets too dry or damaged, then it won't be able to provide a protective barrier against germs. That's why it's important to keep skin clean and moisturised and cover up any cuts and grazes.
Hey, how about some leopard print plasters? That would be a great way to look after yourself and look cool.
They sound like one of your better ideas.
Hallux's Physiology Fix-Up, with support from the Physiological Society. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Hallux.
I got an email here. It's from Charlie Henault, who says, hello, he's from Rhode Island in America. Amazing! All the way across the Atlantic, Charlie. You know, I'm still astounded that anyone listens to this show apart from, like, my nan. Anyway, he's got a question that he wants to ask our science expert, Tom. He says, why are birds always attracted to power lines? Not sure about this one, Charlie. Maybe they just want to rest their feet for a bit and it's the quickest thing that they can fly to. Anyway, thank you so much for the email and question. It's on the pile with some others. Hopefully we can get it answered really soon. Remember, if you want a question answered by our science expert Tom, you need to send it over to my page at funkidslive.com. This week's question is from Davey, who is 8, who asks, how do you make hadron colliders?
So the most famous hadron collider is in CERN in Switzerland. This was made, the purpose of it is to smash atoms together and smash fundamental particles together, so the things that make up atoms. To do this, you need huge magnets to propel the atoms, particles at huge speeds, and you need a lot of space as well to build up that speed. So you need a big magnet and a lot of space.
And how do we get the particles that we're chucking round between these magnets?
So we know certain things emit particles. So when you put them next to the magnet, you know it's going to be propelled really fast. When they collide together, you can see the path of the particles because these collisions are such high energy.
And why are we doing this? What's the point? What are we looking to find?
We're trying to find out what the universe is made up of and how it exists. Most recently, we found the Higgs boson, which is the particle, the God particle, as it's so called, which gives things mass, which has a mass field. We wouldn't know that particle exists unless we perform that experiment in CERN.
Let's have a look at all the science that's been in the news this week then. France is letting its wolf population grow to 500 of them in the next 5 years, despite farmers being a little bit worried. You see, they're panicking about the wolves eating their livestock. You know, their pigs, their cows, their chicken. But because wolves are a protected species, France are reintroducing them into the wild to help the species thrive again. We'll get 500 in the next 5 years. Also, DNA analysis is giving clues to how vampire bats can survive on blood alone. The bat drinks half its weight in blood a day, instead of other bats who have fruit and insects for tea. But vampire bats, they have genes which are mostly immune to the deadly viruses that are carried in blood, so they don't catch anything, any bad stuff from them. And also, the red stuff is very protein rich. And finally, an amateur astronomer caught a supernova on camera the other day. He aimed his telescope at a spiral galaxy, NGC G13, catchy name. Quite lucky, really, because there's no way to predict supernovas, and that's what happens when stars die. I guess it's a good job, then, that astronomers are always so dedicated. They've always got their cameras and telescope pointed in the air, so they can always notice when anything's a little bit unusual. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Stay there. I've got news of a brand new podcast that you might like to listen to in just a sec. First, let's get into our A to Z of food, health and the environment series. We're taking a look at what really goes into the stuff that's on your plate, then goes into your belly. And today, we're going natural.
The Fun Kids A to Z of food, health and the environment. Brought to you by The Cooperative.
Hello, I'm Michael.
And I'm Emily.
Here to introduce the Fun Kids A to Z food, health and the environment. Today's letter is O, and O is for organic food.
You might have seen your parents putting weed killer on the patio or using fertilizer on the garden. Lots of farmers do similar. They spray chemicals called pesticides on their crops to protect them from being eaten by bugs or catching a disease that might stop them growing properly. They also use artificial fertilizers to make crops grow bigger and more quickly. But organic farmers are different. They only use natural pesticides and fertilizers. Another special thing about organic crops is they won't have been genetically modified.
That sounds complicated. What does genetically modified mean?
It's a scientific process where a crop's DNA, the building blocks of every cell, are changed to make it grow bigger and faster. Organic farmers think it's better to let things grow naturally and for us not to eat things that have been changed in this way. Many farmers who aren't farming organically might also inject their livestock with things called hormones and antibiotics to make them grow bigger and stay free of illness. But again, organic farmers believe we should only give the animals medicines when we really have to. They don't believe it's good for us to eat too much meat that has had extra drugs put into it.
So, do organic farmers treat their animals better?
With organic farming, you know that the animal has been kept with more room to exercise and get fresh air. This is called free range. All organic meat is free range, but you can buy free range meat that isn't organic.
Is organic food better for the environment?
Well, the Soil Association, who are one of the biggest organic organisations in Britain, claim that organic farming allows the soil to absorb more carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide contributes to climate change, doesn't it?
That's right. They also say that because fewer chemicals like pesticides are used, organic farms support more wildlife than most other farms. So you'll see more birds, butterflies and wildflowers.
A to Z. Quiz time.
Okay, Michael, you tell me three things that are different about organic food. You can play along at home too.
First, organic food has no genetically modified ingredients.
Well done, that's true. Next one, please.
Are there fewer additives in organic food?
Right. Processors of organic food have to be extra careful with their use of additives. Can you think of anything else?
Well, organic vegetables sometimes look a bit funny.
That might be true, but they're still good for us. Organic farmers think the way something is grown is more important than how it looks.
Well done, Michael. You seem to know lots about organic food. Find out more about farming and organic foods, as well as some yummy recipes to make, on the Fun Kids website.
Time for us to go.
See you next time.
Bye!
The Fun Kids, A to Z of food, health and the environment. Brought to you by the Cooperative.
You can learn loads more about what really goes into the food that you eat. It's dead simple. Listen through wherever you get your podcasts from, you know, places like iTunes. Also, it's all on the free Fun Kids app for your phone or tablet. And you can listen all the time at funkidslive.com. That is it for another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly, then. Thank you so much for listening. Before we go, I want to quickly tell you about another brilliant podcast series that we've got on the go at the moment on Fun Kids. It's brand new, and I think you'll really like it if you've not noticed it before. It's called Story Quest. Each week you get a brand new episode of one of our favourite stories to keep you from getting bored ever. They'll be delivered to your phone for free. You don't need to press a button. Maybe you've got a long car journey, you're having trouble getting to sleep. These stories, they will keep you busy, I promise. You can download Story Quest for free on your phone or tablet. Go to wherever you get your podcast from. It's on the free Fun Kids app as well and over at funkidslive.com. And they're the best places to hear all our other Fun Kids Science series. And remember, you can listen to Fun Kids wherever you are in the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and as always at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.